Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for being here this evening. We really appreciate your support and thank you for coming out. I know midterm break is coming, so we're all eagerly waiting for a long weekend, and I certainly am. But I want to start with something small by asking you a very simple question that has rather large significance. And that is, when you're saying, how's it to somebody? How's your day going? And in South Africa, it's almost a tradition to say, oh, it's okay, surviving, you know, getting there. Sure, this year is fast, it's going hard. But what does it actually say about us? Is that not negative self-speak? Is that not us diminishing what used to be great? I'm actually having a good day. Is it us negating the gratitude of something well that has happened and recognizing somebody's service to us or contribution in our lives? And I think that's why the theme of today, which is moving from surviving to thriving, is so important, because ultimately our words create our reality, doesn't it? And that's why we have language. Our language creates our reality, and the more we say the things, the more it becomes real. So tonight we're going to have a conversation about surviving to thriving, and I'm sitting with two people who can help us do that. And I'm just going to give you an introduction, and the aim of this evening is not to create another Facebook, you know, or Twitter or Instagram slogan. It's really asking you to reflect on our own behavior and things that we do as a community or a village raising children, and for children in that community, to actually contribute to an upliftment rather than something that just keeps taking away. Because we all have a duty to each other to hold each other accountable, to be positive, to contribute, to be of service to each other as well. So on my left-hand side, I have Candace York. We met her through her mom, who used to do a lot of the assessments for EduInc, and we've had a very good and long-standing relationship with the mom, and she shipped the mom off to PE? No?
Knysna.
I think half of Joburg is Knysna, where they're retiring. Candace is a counseling psychologist registered with the HPCSA with 10 years of working experience with the teenagers and school-going children. A member of the Bella Vista SEEK team. She specializes in psychoeducational and neurological assessment. The therapeutic approach integrates CBT, DBT, and play therapies, all grounded in the relationship between therapist and client. And then somebody who needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce her anyway, is Jacqueline Aitchison, who holds an MSc in psychology from Liverpool John Moores University, where her thesis explored the shift from learned helplessness to psychological capacity, building tools for teenagers for lifelong flourishing. She holds an MA in educational leadership at PGC and a BA from UNISA. And as you well know, Jack served as the executive head for EduInc for 13 years and is now the current chairperson of EduInc's board. Her driving passion is growing people. I think you're in a good place. I think a lot of us are all about growing people. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
So before we get going, Jax, there's something that I'm going to ask you to just start the conversation with. And I think it's very important for us to differentiate between pursuing happiness and pursuing flourishing. And can you just unpack this for us a little bit and what it might look and feel like, please?
The difference between happiness and flourishing.
Pursuing
happiness and pursuing flourishing. I think the pursuit of happiness has really become quite a diluted concept thanks to social media and the influences that are around us.
You mean the Kardashians? Okay. Sorry, I just had to agree
with you. It must be. You know, if you think about, especially our teenagers, they are surrounded with TikTok and Instagram and all these things where only the best of the best is seen. So there's this constant reinforcement where if your life is not being lived at this super high level all the time, you must be doing something wrong, or there must be something wrong with you, or you must be depressed, or you must be, you clearly don't have enough friends or the right people around you because you're not living at this exceptional level all the time, which is just not the truth at all. You know, I read the other day that the happiness industry in 2025 was worth over $6.4 trillion. So the happiness industry being the wellness industry, your self-help books on, you know, follow these 10 steps to happiness, or workplace well-being, or this course, or this retreat, or whatever it is that they are selling that we are just falling for, because we have this urge to live the Instagram level life. Because if I'm not living that life, I'm clearly not happy. So that's why I say, I think the concept of happiness has actually been diluted, and we actually don't know what that word really means anymore. And this is perhaps why it's better to start using words like flourishing, well-being, because they have more meaning for us. From a clinical perspective, flourishing, from a positive psychology perspective, flourishing is when you are no longer just coping, surviving. So pathology would be when you are in a state of disease or dis-ease, which would then, you know, you get treatment and it takes you back to a coping level. You want to realize that that's not enough. We need to work towards flourishing, not just coping, and that there are ways and means of teaching ourselves to do that. And that is what leads us to a very meaningful life. It's not about happiness every day. It's about having meaning in our lives and living a meaningful life. I think one of the other big distinctions for me when I really think about these concepts is that at the moment, happiness feels like a very inward concept. I need to do this, and I need to look like that, and I need to be, you know, involved with these people and do this. Whereas a life of meaning turns the focus more outward, because to have meaning in your life, you have to be contributing to something greater than yourself. And as soon as you think about contributing to something greater than yourself, you have to look outside of yourself. You cannot be completely focused on the self all the time. You have to go, well, what is my place here? And how do I fit in to that environment and that community? And how do I make them better? Once we start doing that, happiness tends to take care of itself. That's how I see it at the moment.
So if I can paraphrase a little bit, it sounds like the pursuit of happiness can be quite a selfish endeavor and self-centered endeavor, whereas the pursuit of flourishing is a meaningful endeavor, and humans create meaning being of service or contributing to or building something, because that's where we get the feedback of we are worth something, we have self-worth, etc. And essentially that's where we flourish, when we feel that we have value and we have worth and we are contributing towards something.
Absolutely. And I think it's a better reflection of how we work when we are working in the space of well-being. We work to developing our emotional intelligence. Because remember, emotional intelligence is about my capacity or my ability to understand my emotions and how they make me behave, and the emotions of other people and understanding their behaviors. It's not just all about me. It's both sides of the same coin.
It's quite interesting because, you know, you're talking social media. When someone said, define one word that says social media to you, and I'm going selfies. And selfies means about self. And perhaps that might be a connection that's worth exploring. Candace, you've got more, you're dealing with this more clinically.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you've got an opinion or something you'd like to add to this. Please share with us what you're thinking around this.
Just when Jax was talking, it did make me think quite a lot about a lot of the work that's being done in ACT, which is acceptance commitment therapy. And one of the big gurus or leaders in that realm wrote a book called The Happiness Trap. And I think by no means is he saying, and I don't think any of us are saying, that happiness isn't a goal worth pursuing. Absolutely not. But I think we can become caught up in thinking that happiness is the only goal, and that a life is only worthwhile, or I'm only having a good day if I'm feeling happy. And that the minute something is not happy, as put it, as a negative or a hard emotion, that then equals a distress, or this is now a bad day. And I think we can sort of become quite tunnel visioned in that things need to go in a certain way, and that happiness is the only pursuit or the only goal, when actually we need the ups and downs. Well, we also we can't avoid the ups and downs, and not to oversimplify it, but we also can't be so upset by the fact that there are downs. It is, and that's got a lot to do with the acceptance and commitment part, is that we rock and roll and surf the waves of the ups and downs. And of course, we've got to put things in to become better surfers, but we can't avoid the downs.
So what I'm hearing is to move into flourishing, we need to become better surfers.
Yeah.
Metaphorically or physically? Because I'm also heading down to the urban.
Well, you know, I sent my mom to Nasna, so I think you can see I'm for both.
I think what you do, you're touching on something that's very important, because, you know, Jackson and I had conversations about this, obviously leading up to it, and it's part of what we have to deal with on a daily basis. And I said to Jax, I strive most days to be content.
Yeah, because good is content, good enough.
Good is good enough, and then when something great happens, then I can experience happiness.
Yeah.
And when something that sucks happens, I feel down, but I'm moving towards contentment, knowing that that height of happiness is not always sustainable, and it comes at a cost.
Yeah. So, well, I think most things worthwhile do come at a cost. Mm. Yeah.
But maintaining happiness can come at a cost too, if you're trying to do it all the time.
Yeah, I think, and
that's where the dopamine hit come in. That's where you're online all the time. Yeah.
Well, and I know we probably will go into it a bit more later, but I think when we're trying to avoid that which could take away from our happiness, or that which could cause distress, you know, that avoidance of the something that's scary, avoiding asking that person out or avoiding asking the teacher the question, in that we actually create a sort of prolonged suffering. Maybe it's an instant relief. Oh, I didn't have to, you know, step out onto the plate. But prolonged, it creates a greater sense of anxiety. I miss out on what could have been a good opportunity, or maybe just a learning opportunity.
A learning opportunity.
Yeah.
I think part of what we're going to talk about tonight is that frustration, you know, we are driven by two motivations to learn. One is curiosity and the other is frustration. And if we are not curious about something, which often creates a frustration because you get to a certain point that then forces us to learn, if we don't face difficulties, if we're always happy, what is the motivation to learn? If we don't have some of those downs and the bad days that create the frustration, what is our motivation to learn about ourselves, about how to handle things better, how to handle difficult situations better, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes we need a bit of fire to give us a kick in the right, well, not the right direction, in any direction.
Yeah.
It doesn't always have to be the right direction.
Yeah.
Just about musing again.
Yeah.
And some of the best frustration for learning that precedes learning is when you've created frustration for yourself because you haven't done something properly, haven't acknowledged something yourself, because the learning is deeper then, because you've been the own cause of it.
Mm.
Okay, that went down a nice little rabbit hole. I enjoyed that.
I don't think I answered any of your questions, just, gave you something to chew on.
I think that, Jax, I want to jump back into what, because I think it's more pertinent to what we were discussing right now, is the two very different approaches to adolescent well-being. And one is focused on diagnosing what is wrong, which you're talking about, the distress, the disease or dis-ease. And the other is about building what is strong. Can you walk us through what a parent or a student sitting here tonight can recognize in their own lives, that I'm only dealing with diagnosing and focusing what's wrong to get to a coping space and not necessarily working on what I'm good at and what my strengths are to move into a flourishing space, and understanding that we all kind of move in between and out of those spaces?
It's quite tricky.
Well, maybe talk about the medical model.
Biomedical approach, and the reason I did the analysis of it was specifically because there's been a lot of research into how the traditional biomedical approach can tend to pathologize normal behaviors. And it can also, so we live in a world now of over-medicalization. We look for a diagnosis as soon as we feel discontented or unhappiness. Oh, there must be something wrong that we can put a label on. Because if we can put a label on it, we can give it a pill. That's biomedical. the problem is that it also leads to a process where an adolescent in particular becomes a passive recipient of the care. You sit over there and you do what I tell you to do and you take the medication because I'm the expert. I'm the doctor with all the degrees. I will tell you how to manage this problem. And the adolescent becomes more and more passive in the process to the point where they lose any kind of agency. And they start to internalize the problem. So it's no longer, I am a person who is struggling with this. It's now, I am a problem. I have a problem with this, I have this problem, that problem. I can't do this anymore because I've got this. So in other words, the diagnosis starts to become an excuse. I cannot interact with society or engage in these behaviors because of this diagnosis and this label and that label and these medications. Now, there's obviously the caveat that in severe cases of severe pathology, of course, the biomedical approach is the right approach. It is appropriate. But I'm talking about the moment we are put into a position of growth, for example. Growth is not meant to feel comfortable. Growth is a state of discomfort. That doesn't mean you're doing something wrong. In fact, it means the opposite. If we can learn to sit in that discomfort, feel the discomfort, name the discomfort, and see the discomfort, we are teaching ourselves capacity skills. When we have, well, my child has social anxiety, so please, teacher, they can't do an oral in front of the class. Please don't ever make them answer a question out loud, and please don't ever make them do a speech. That is just the worst thing that can happen. You have removed all tool building right there. And that child has been robbed of the ability to develop life skills that they will need for the rest of their lives. So that's not helpful. What was the second part of your question?
So that's about the biomedical model, where the second part is the building the capacity, building the ability to focus on your strengths, what you're good at, etc. And so thriving.
I think the first thing I should probably point out here is that, you know, at school we talk a lot about resilience and grit. These are words that you guys hear all the time. And there's a difference between capacity and resilience. Those are two different things. Capacity comes first. Capacity is your assets, your resources that you draw on when life takes you out at the knees. You're going to go down. There is no way you can avoid that. Life is going to take you out at the knees from time to time. The resilience comes after the fact, when you brush yourself down and you keep going. If you don't have capacity, you can't get up in order to keep going, to brush yourself down and keep going. Capacity gets you back up off the ground. Resilience makes you brush yourself down and try again. That's the difference between the two, if that makes sense.
How would you add grit to that analogy?
Well, grit is the you know, doing a difficult thing for a prolonged period of time. Matric is a very gritty year. You need to be able to focus intensively for a very long period of time. It's difficult for a long period of time. That's grit. Okay, so that's the difference between capacity, resilience, and grit. And of course, all of those are directly to do with flourishing. We work on these skills in order to be able to flourish. Maybe a way to do it, to explain it, an analogy could be, I want to go and play rugby for South Africa. I've seen the Springboks win 2 World Cups in a row, and they have all this fame and acclaim and all this. It looks fantastic, and I'm going to go and do that. So I read a book on playing rugby. Then the first time I go onto the field, this guy comes along and he tackles me and he takes me out at the knees and I hit the ground really hard and I skin my knee and I've got grass stains all down my clothes. And I stand up and go, that wasn't meant to happen. That guy was meant to kick the ball. I was going to catch the ball and I was going to jump over the try line. Done. You go, but that's not rugby. There's a whole bit here on you getting tackled and scrums and where your ears are going to get pulled in the scrum and this is going to hurt. Yeah, but I didn't read that chapter because, you know, it triggered me. Or, and I'm going to say the provocative thing, my mom took that chapter out of the book because it was a bit violent. That's what we're dealing with.
I can't believe you went there. So I think what's important for us to acknowledge is that we're not saying that medication's bad. Often therapy is required, especially when somebody is in a state of deep depression, to medicate them to a point where they are able to start building capacity for themselves. And once that capacity has been built, weaning them off the antidepressants so they are able to actually then use the tools that they've learned and engage with the capacity that they've learned. Capacity is not putting more pipes in your dam, it's creating a bigger dam, creating more space to put in, and then you can put more pipes in. So that's your AQ, so that you can get more output. Okay? So I think that's very important. We're not saying don't medicate if medication is required, because often if you're in a state that you need to get to a point of being able to be built. But a lot of medication happens where we get to the point of feeling that we are in control again, but no capacity is built around that. So when the medication stops, we go back down to where we started again.
So this is a conversation I had with a couple of people last week, and it's not growth if it doesn't move you forward. Growth is uncomfortable and it doesn't feel great, because remember, our brains are wired to keep us safe, not make us happy. So growth is going to feel uncomfortable because your brain is going back. Just you go back to the pattern you know. It doesn't matter if it was destructive. You know that it's safe. Go back there. So growth is going to feel uncomfortable. But if you go through that and then go, okay, I'm feeling better now, so I'm just going to keep doing what I've always done, and then I go back into growth and it feels uncomfortable, and then I go back. You're just on a hamster wheel. Real growth is when you can sit with that discomfort, name it, figure it out, understand why you are uncomfortable. What is making me uncomfortable here? And move forward. What have I learned from this? Oh, I've learned that if I take the bull by the horns and I get up and I do the presentation in front of my class, for example, actually, I'm braver than I thought. It gives you the template and the model to know that you've done it once before, therefore you can get back there again. Then you are learning from the growth and moving forward. That's a healthy place to be. You're developing capacity then.
Yeah, and I think also just to that, I think when you said the hamster wheel, I was thinking in the cycle of growth, and you say we have to move forward, I think actually you spoke to it earlier with the flourishing and purpose, that I need to move forward, but in which direction?
And why?
Yeah, and the why, which is supposed, you know, speaks to values and service.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, yes. I think that cycle is very easy, yes, to repeat. And often in therapy, when I work with teenagers or adults, where they've got to the point of, well, why bother?
Yeah.
You know.
What's the point?
Yeah. Fail all the tests. Ugh, well, why bother? Stop going to the practice, or stop messaging this person, whatever it is. When you get to that, why bother?
Yeah. Absolute futility. Well, there's no point in even trying.
Yeah.
So one
dangerous point to get.
Yeah, 100%. You spoke, you know, in your introduction, your bio, you work closely with the relationship between the child and the parents, because that's important. And I mentioned that it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
You can't do therapy in isolation.
No.
And you know, part of my question is, when you're sitting dealing with an adolescent or a young adult, and you are working through this, they come to you because there's an issue, there's a crisis. Okay. How much of that is broken? And by whom? The system, the school, the parents, by themselves? And how much of it was never built in the first place? Mm. In other words, we're asking them to provide water from a dam that hasn't been built yet.
Yeah.
So let's just dig into that a little bit, because this is not about pointing fingers. It's an acknowledgement of who has what responsibilities, where do they need to go? And that includes the child, because they have responsibility and agency in the same space.
Literally, yeah.
So, you know, without poking the bear too much, just
let's naming names.
Yeah, talk honestly about who's got what roles and what needs to be built and by whom.
Yeah. Look, and I think, you know, when you speak to what has been broken and what was never there in the first place, I think there's a case for both. And I think I've seen both in practice. Just speaking to that, and I'm thinking a lot sort of in terms of assessments and where students are coming and almost in that why bother stage. And I think there we have to be realistic and honest, and that's where we have to go in terms of treatment plan, as to, you know, different schools offer different things. And I always hope there that schools can be very honest with their students and parent bodies as to what support they can offer. You know, is this a child with different learning needs or different emotional needs? What can they offer? Because it's no use keeping a child in an environment and not being able to support that child adequately, because then they do come feeling very broken, because year in, year out, you go in and you're failing, and you try a bit of this, try a bit of that, or eventually you give up on the trying, and you've become the incapable child to the naughty child, and then they do come feeling very, very broken. But then, and I think something you're very passionate about is, okay, well, what is the next step? So, of course, the therapy or the assessment can give us the insight into what is this that the child needs. But then the responsibility, well, I think then it does take a village. Yes, and in terms of educational needs, we need to identify what therapies or what school setting that child needs to be in. But I think there is then a huge onus on one, us as a team, building that child up to a position of, I want to try, I can try, I can do this, or maybe I can't do everything, but I can do that. And in that process, re-engaging the responsibility in the child. Because, you know, especially in that, you know, where someone's been let down by the system, it's not fair, it's not right, and we wish it doesn't happen to anyone. But it does, and that's sometimes the cards we dealt. But now what?
So
it's me that's got to
do the work.
Yeah, I mean, I worked just, sorry.
So it sounds like to me that the first steps from I can't do this, I don't want to do this, is creating a support system where the first steps of agency start taking place.
Yeah.
I can do this. So taking control.
Yeah.
To a point where that control becomes responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Because responsibility is not responsibility without consequence.
Yeah.
So I earn, and it's a big step to go from support and helping to give agency to I'm now in control, which means I'm responsible for the outcome as well.
Yeah.
And that could be the first time we fail and go back into the spiral again.
Yeah. And that, you know, there you speak to responsibility with consequence. Well, what is the consequence? Because if I've got to a point where, well, I don't want to learn, I don't want to be in the school system, the education system's let me down, send me out to surf, the real surf, not the emotional surf.
Yeah.
Then the consequence doesn't really matter.
Yeah, fair enough.
Which, you know, and then I think that's where we try work on a lot of the sort of value system and some and the hard
the reason for
true to that because the tough reality is you probably are going to have to stay in the school system. I mean, there's some choice within this, but you can maybe go to this school or that school, but we probably can't change that. You're going to need to be be going to school. So then the consequence is, okay, well, I don't go to the extra lessons, I don't do my homework. Sure, the consequence, maybe you don't care that the teacher's cross or your parents are cross, but could a consequence be that, well, actually, that made me feel pretty lousy? Or does it make me feel like I'm going in, you know, I've got to be at this place 6 hours a day.
So
what do I do with it?
So maybe the way I'm going with this is that if the consequence of responsibility is internalized personally, it can be a positive motive moving forward.
Yeah.
But if we impose negative consequences or consequences externally in that part of the growth process, it's just going to defeat the whole purpose.
I think we'll probably be case specific, but in this case where there's that why bother attitude, the external, well, especially when the external is the school system or whatever the hated or the let down system is.
So where do we go from? So we've spoken about the school system. Where do the parents and the child play a role in this?
Yeah. So I think the child we spoke to a little bit, and that's taking on that responsibility, or what value do I want to work to, even if it's just making my day a little bit more pleasant. Parents are it's a very tough role, because on one hand you've seen this child suffer.
Yeah.
You're also the person that's having to drive them to school every day, which is not always an easy job if you've got someone kicking and screaming or complaining about homework. And I think there, a lot of it comes into having those boundaries of being in that parental role of saying, I know you don't want to do this, but you've got to go. It's kind of like the making you eat your vegetables.
Yeah.
I can't help it that you've got to eat your vegetables, but I can sit with you at the table, or I can add cheese sauce. So we've got to do the hard stuff, but I am here. I can try and make it better to the best of my abilities, but I can't take away all the hard.
Yeah.
Can I jump in there? I think it's exactly what we were speaking about earlier with the learned helplessness versus the agency. Mm. If we are going to help adolescents and children navigate all of this, whether they're coming from a broken position or whether they are just legitimately trying to build capacity skills to be able to navigate their world, it's a team sport. Mm. Even with a child with deep pathology, right through to the one who's okay. The child's okay most of the time, but could do with a bit of extra help here and there when they're hitting a prolonged downer. It's a team sport. And this is where a whole framework has to come into play, where the family, the child, him or herself, and the school, the community, the school and the teachers and everybody else needs to be involved in this framework of developing the skills that this child needs for this particular context. If you're trying to do it only as the family without the school or the child, then you're as good as the doctor who's just saying, I'm the professional, just pay attention and do what you're told. Same goes for the school. If the school's saying, family, just do what you're told, it's not going to work. You're coming at it from one angle only, where it has to be a full circle. And the agency, this is one of my own personal passions, bugbears, I don't know what you want to call it, but the agency of the child is paramount. It's what you were talking about with buy-in. A child who's deep in the learned helplessness space has gotten to that point of futility. Well, what's the point of even trying? There's nothing I can do. Nothing I can do. Nothing's going to change. You know, they're really in a bad way. We can't, as responsible adults, leave them there. Mm-mm. We can't just go, okay, well.
No, Sherry is too anxious.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. That's negligent. As far as I'm concerned, that's negligent as an adult, a significant adult in that child's life. We have to keep trying to bring that child to a point, and whether that's through medication, it often is, just giving them the medical help or the chemical help just to get them back to a point where they can feel in sufficient control to start taking agency for themselves. However that manifests, we have to get them back to the point where they can start taking the reins back and saying, okay, I'm going to try this, or I'm going to try that. That went well. That didn't really work for me, in whatever capacity that is. And it's not a quick fix. It's not a war that we win once. We all go through this war and we battle it out and then, yay, it's sorted out. Victory is ours. It doesn't work like that, unfortunately. It's a series of battles that rear their heads and we have to all come together and pick it up again, and then it gets better for a while. And we go through this whole sequence of battles to get this child to a point of sufficient agency where they can do this as an adult for themselves.
I think the difficult truth is that I'm sitting reflecting on everything that we're talking about right now. And I think we spend a lot of time at school and as parents orientating ourselves towards making kids happy. or at least not unhappy. And I think that I think that we're robbing them of some of the frustration that's required to want to learn. And I think too many parents, a lot of the breakdown in asking what's broken or not being built is when parents don't realize that parenting means, or teaching means, that your child or your student doesn't like you. And my comment is always, I'd rather have you not like me now than despise me at 25 because I haven't been an adult. And I often say to them, if you don't like me right now, it's generally because I'm probably doing my job properly. And I think that's very important. It's not appropriate for you to be friends with your teenage child, be friendly towards them. You can be friends later when you're adults because there's a mutual respect. But the power relationship between adult and parent doesn't mean. The power relationship between teacher and headmaster and parent and student means that it's not appropriate for children to be friends with the adult and see them as a mentor, but later they can become friends. And I think we need to understand that your kids not liking you at times means you're doing your job properly. You should be ticking it off going, yes, not every day, but you've drawn a line in the sand, and that's important. And that means you stuck to that boundary because kids respond to those boundaries.
Can I say so? So when we're to my son, because I always repeat that once. So my way, get him home, make high now, because just those words, I still realize it's me doing it. It's my job to choose. But
you brought in the trade. No, which is like the lesson that I absolutely has to do.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Trix. I think what also strikes me through the conversation is that nobody decides to become helpless. No one decides to go, I'm going to learn how to be helpless and useless and not contribute to society or have any agency. But like with most human beings, we learn through experience. And the repeated experience reinforces that that is the behavior that's appropriate. And the question I have for both of you, and you can both jump in together or have a conversation around this, is when do we and how do we as a society and a community create experiences that children get to the point where this is what they are? They believe they have no say, they have no control, they have no agency, and that they are not able to contribute. They don't have any purpose, and that they will never be happy. So let's talk a little bit about what we are doing as community. And I'm hoping that being friends with parents comment is maybe part of that. But let's talk about, sit honestly and talk about the difficult part. What are we doing wrong as a community, as teachers in schools, headmasters in schools, as parents that are creating this learned helplessness? And it is learned. It doesn't just happen with our younger kids. And I'm more than happy to have you guys talk about it and give some feedback too.
I think that's a huge question. We could talk about that question alone for an hour.
So let's start. We've got time.
But not for an hour. I think I'll talk a little bit about what we see, and then maybe you can jump in from a more clinical perspective. For us, I think in the school setting, when we are dealing with children and teenagers, and even some adults that we deal with, the learned helplessness is kind of conflated with victimhood and victim status. And again, the society that we live in has really propagated this victim status mentality.
Victim has power.
We talk about this all the time. Our kids know it at school because we talk about it at school. It's the staff know because we hear talk. You know, Gersh and I often talk about Karpman's drama triangle. If you've never looked at Karpman's drama triangle, go and look at it, because the victim sits at the bottom point of the triangle, and it's the victim that holds all the control and holds all the power. So I'll give you an example, one that you guys will understand and relate to. You write a math test that you didn't study for. Okay, you were busy playing or doing whatever you were doing, and you didn't put enough work into this math test. You went and you wrote it, and you failed it properly. Okay. So now you're sitting there and you're thinking, when I get into the car this afternoon and I tell my mother what this mark is, it's going to be hell. This is not going to go well. So you start coming up with your narrative. And by the time mom fetches you, You get in the car and mom says, how did your math test go? First question she has. She doesn't even ask, how was your day? How's your math test? And your response to her is, you know, that test had questions in it that we were never taught. Sound familiar? Oh, that test had questions we were never taught. So I claim my victim status and I try and force my mom to rescue me. I want mom to go stomping into the school and say, why did you give my test with questions that were never taught? So mom has, you are holding the power. So you are forcing mom to make a choice at that moment. Okay. Mom has to decide now. Do I rescue my darling, precious little angel by storming into the school going, why were you giving my child tests on work that was never taught? Or mom uses mom's common sense, which moms tend to do, and mom goes, that doesn't sound right. Why on earth would that happen? I'll tell you what, I'll find out. But this sounds a bit hinky to me. And mom maybe asks a question. Maybe she puts it on the group or she phones in and she says, listen, this is the story. What's going on here? This doesn't sound right. And teacher will invariably say, well, in every good assessment, there is going to be one or two questions your child has never seen before. That's what your highest cognitive level is all about. The application of knowledge to something new. A synthesis of information to create something new. And mom goes, yeah, okay, of course that makes sense. So it's fun. Now, part of mom's choice here is to either yell at the teacher and rescue the child. So the child's holding the power. The child's forced you to rescue. Or mom goes, hang on a minute. That's not making any sense. And says, listen here. You are just making up stories now because you didn't do very well in this test and you don't want to get into trouble. And then what do? You turn around and you go, you know, you never support me when it counts. You're never on my side. So the child is still holding the power because they've moved you now from the position of rescuing them to the position of persecuting them. Still holding all the power. So you need to get out of that completely. That victim status, we are seeing it everywhere. You turn on a TV show and you watch episodes of whatever you choose and the hero's boyfriend dumps her and all her friends rally around going, he's such a terrible guy. They don't say, oh, what happened? Were there two sides of the story? That doesn't sound right. That, in other words, don't write critical thinking into the script. It doesn't sell. Write victimhood and persecutors and rescuers and all this real danger.
Well, that's danger, drama, isn't it?
Yeah. That's drama.
Yeah.
But now we're translating that into real life and we're wondering why we are unfulfilled and unhappy and feeling at a loose end and how to navigate this world when everything around us is telling us it's supposed to be like this. Our work is understanding that that's not reality. So that's my tangent. It's linking the victimhood into the learned helplessness because we are seeing so much of it.
Let's just try the Z again. Carbon, K-A-R-P, M-A-V. Hopnum and Dog. And I feel like just something to add on. It's not always the case, but it's definitely something I see quite a lot of. And hear me out, because I don't think any parent wants to see their child suffer. I don't think anyone comes in with that malicious, yes, you must suffer. Absolutely not. I think we want our children to thrive, but I think there is a position where we can be very quick to remove discomfort, remove, you know, the obstacle. And we have to then think of, well, what is our own capacity to see our child or our teen struggle? And it often resonates with parents, and they say, often when do an assessment and then you feedback, and that's exactly, you know, what I went through, and I never ever wanted my little boy to go through that. And sometimes it's so interesting that something that we try avoid so much actually ends up having the same result. And I often see, yeah, often see parents coming in because they can't tolerate the ups and downs, or witnessing their child on ups and downs. And I think you all hear me out that no parent has malicious intent.
No.
But I can't see this little one suffer.
Well, I think it's a really, really difficult one. And this is one of the hardest parts of parenting, to see your child in distress and to be able to make the decision yourself. What is the right thing to do here? Do I dive in to remove the discomfort and what's giving them the distress? Or is this one of these situations where they absolutely need to feel it? You know, if I think about it, one of the things that I was reading about was grief.
Mm.
You know, a teenager loses their grandparent or a significant adult in their life. And they are really struggling to deal with this grief. Unfortunately, we're in a stage now where if that grief is prolonged over a certain amount of weeks, according to DSM-5, and if it presents with this and this, suddenly it's a major depressive episode. You know, it gets labeled and medicated, where it's actually just real grief that needs to be experienced and processed as a fundamental building block for that teenager to function as an adult. Mm. So for the parent, it's going, do I jump in and protect the child or not? I don't know. If you protect the child, about making your child feel better, whereas by not protecting the child is maybe preparing the child, I don't know, about becoming better rather than feeling better right now in the moment.
I would think that applies to various. For example, let's take this to the extreme. A child meets as a grandparent and they grieve for, say, 3 years, just in this depressive state, crying all the time, they lost grandparents, missing them. Would that still be a grief, and you still give that child time to grieve? Would you intervene at that point?
We're definitely saying you're intervening. That's a, you know, it's a very extreme. It's probably not grief anymore after 3 years. It's probably not grief anymore. So intervention is required, and that's when I said you've always got to bear in mind that serious pathology still needs medical intervention. That is a caveat to this whole thing. A 3-year grieving period. No, that's not grief anymore. An intervention is required.
So I think 3 years where you have intermittent grief, where periods are getting further and further apart, is what we'd normally try and expect and see.
Yeah. And on the run from wellness all the way to your psychopathology, we'll always look at functionality.
Yes.
And how is this person functioning in their everyday life? And if we were to speak of that sort of very extended grief period where he's like, you know, crying every day, well, is that person able to meaningfully function? Probably not. And then that would be place for parental and professional input.
So, and just to clarify for you what functioning means, functioning is when you can maintain normal relationships, your friendships, your family relationships, or in the case of adults, maintain your job. If you're no longer able to keep your job because you are in heaps of tears all the time, you're not functioning.
Can you do life?
Can you do life? Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is that there's a real difference between protecting your child from difficulty and preparing your child for difficulty. Because most of us default to protection because it feels like that's what it means to be a good parent. And that's what it feels like to express love and to be responsible as an adult. But at the same time, we need to actually sit back and question that intelligently and reflect on what that looks like, because we don't want to rob them of building something they actually need to grow as a human being.
You know, there's a great analogy for this that I remember Gavin used this analogy years and years and years ago. And he used the analogy of a parent teaching a child to ride a bicycle. Now, when a parent buys a bicycle for a child, they buy the bicycle knowing the child's going to fall off, right? That child's going to fall off the bike and skin their knee and their elbow and whatever the case may be. And when we teach the child to ride the bicycle, we start by holding the saddle, right? We're running behind them and we're holding the saddle and we're going until they get enough momentum to go by themselves. Because you know the bicycle, if you're going too slowly, you fall over. So you need momentum to keep going. So they get enough momentum. We let go of the saddle, but we still let go of the saddle knowing they're going to lose the momentum and probably fall off. As a parent at that point, what do we do? Do we say, come on, let me fix your knee and your elbow, and then we're going to try again? Or do we say, oh, no, my darling, let me ride the bicycle for you? Or, no, no, let's put that bicycle in the garage and never look at it again. So are we dealing with what's happening right now, the hurt feelings, the low feelings? Are we trying to make them feel better right now by putting the bandage on their knee and then saying, come, let's go? Or do we help them become what they need to be in the long term by saying, come, we're going to get back on this bicycle. Let's try again. Let's try again. Let's try again. I'm right here next to you. I'm still running next to you, but let's try again. You're not doing this on your own. Let's try again.
So I think we've identified clearly what we can look at to determine what we might be doing wrong, what we should be doing theoretically as a framework. And what I'd like to do is start diving into the actual non-theoretical, the takeaways, the things that as parents, as educators, as students, that we can say we're on the right path, we are building capacity with the point of wanting to thrive, of wanting to do difficult and harder things better, because life is not going to just get easy. And understanding that happiness is not this utopian space where we get to do nothing, have lots of money, and do what we like. That's not happiness, because even then you're going to get bored and look for something else. But happiness, or rather the joy, comes from being of service, of building something, being meaningful, having responsibility, etc. So what do we need to build around that as the adults, as the community, and what do kids need to do? The practical tools that we need to put in place for this to happen.
For me, one of the biggest things for the adults and the children is to understand that building capacity, in other words, building the ability to live a life of meaning and of well-being, takes work. It's not something that operates in a vacuum or that falls out of the ether and hits you on the head. You have to actively participate in a process. And like I said before, that means it's going to get uncomfortable. Because like learning how to play a rugby match or run the comrades or whatever, it's going to get sore sometimes. It's going to feel hard sometimes. And our brains are going to keep trying to default us back into the old patterns. That's how we work. That's how we are wired to work. So for me, the departure point is understanding that I need to be okay with sitting with the hurt, with the discomfort. And I need to understand that that doesn't mean I'm doing something wrong and that I need to change this so that the discomfort stops. Life is going to bring you discomfort all the time. That's what life does. But the more discomfort we face and the more capacity we allow it to build through learning from the discomfort, the better we will become at doing the difficult things. We'll get better and better at doing it, but we have to put the work in first. The work is things like developing the emotional intelligence and understanding what that means and practicing it. Understand that it's about my community as well as about me and the emotions on both sides of that coin and practicing that. Putting myself in situations where I feel a bit uncomfortable, where I'm not always in my comfort zone. Comfort zones create a rut. A rut becomes a prison. We don't want to be there. That's not human growth. That's not flourishing, and it's not well-being. That's not us living our best lives. That's living the easy life, and that's not a happy space. We need to understand ourselves well enough to know what our coping mechanisms are, because they're going to be different for everyone. Yours are going to be different to your parents. And that's fine, because you are not your parents. You're your own person. So for you, it might be journaling. It might be, I don't know, what different coping mechanisms do you have? It could be sport, exercise. Those are good coping mechanisms. Those are good self-care activities. A coping mechanism is not saying, I've had a really rough day, so I'm going to go and game until midnight. That's avoidance. That's bad. That's dangerous. That's not dealing with anything. That's checking out instead of leaning in. So that's, yeah, there's my two cents on that.
And I think, you know, just on the point of coping and coping skills, because it is, I mean, it's a big buzzword. It's something we focus on a lot in therapy, and it's good, it's essential, it needs to happen. But I think there's also become a danger where we're almost always in coping mode.
Absolutely.
Where have a difficult feeling or a feeling of challenge or I hit an obstacle. Okay, and I've got to cope, which is right. Yes, we do need to cope. Why? To reduce the distress, to get back into that sort of regulated state where I can think again, you know, my thinking brain is activated. Just saying that coping mechanisms, hugely important, essential. They allow us to calm down, to regulate the nervous system, to get that thinking brain back online so that I can make good decisions. I think my worry, and this is, I suppose, anecdotal experience in therapy and assessments, is that there's a almost over need for coping. And here my sort of question is, how do we get to a place where I'm always needing a coping mechanism, or I'm so frequently needing coping mechanisms, and how do I get to a point where my capacity is greater that I'm not needing to pull out these coping mechanisms quite so often?
100%, I couldn't agree with what you're saying more. I think a lot of people think the coping mechanism is the fix.
Yeah.
Without realizing that the coping mechanism is just the tool to calm the nervous system enough for that neocortex to come back into action.
Yeah.
Then you start doing the work on the fix.
Yeah.
But I also like what you're saying is, if we don't have the dam with capacity, we're constantly relying on the coping mechanisms, which is also not how it should be.
Yeah. There's a lovely analogy of, you know, life being our backpack. Mm. And we all get different backpacks. And some of us have a lot of stones, some not so many stones or weights in our backpack. And who knows what lies ahead. But I mean, we've all got to get to the top of the mountain. And usually it's quite nice to be at the top of the mountain. There's a good view. It's worthwhile. And with coping, we're often taking some of the stones out, or we're stopping for a rest. Again, not a bad thing. Or giving my pack to someone for a little bit of the walk. Again, not a bad thing. Is it enough to get me to the top of the mountain? Probably not. Well, it's not the most effective way, that's for sure. So we've got to look at, how do I actually strengthen my muscles that I can carry this pack to the top of the mountain and enjoy the view.
By myself.
Yeah.
And feel good about it.
Yeah. And I know we've chatted a lot about sort of what goes into emotional capacity. But I think one of my favorite things is, it falls under the heading of emotional differentiation, but I think there's a label for everything in psychology.
Yeah.
But it's being in that position where two things are true at the same time. Mm. I can be scared and show up at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I can be nervous and excited. I can be embarrassed but determined. And for me, that's that's a great deal to do with building capacity.
100%. 100%. So the and conversations instead of the or conversations.
That's it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for our kids, also just the reminder that when you are working on things like capacity, it's always good to have the sounding board to bring you perspectives that you lose sight of at times.
Yeah.
And you need to be very discerning about who that is. Remember, if you're going to pull the victim card, then you're going to run to your friends because you're trying to recruit your allies, right? Is that building capacity? No. You need to have your people who you can go and talk to who are going to show you the mirror and say, that's what's happening right now. What are you going to do about it? That's how you are learning to deal with the discomfort, feeling it, being okay with it, and learning how to come through the other side of it. You know, you'll find a lot of it's a lot of information out there on psychotherapy and capacity and all of these things. And the one thing that's coming up quite a lot is how a lot of these psychological terms have become very misused to create excuses. In fact, I was listening to a talk earlier and she was talking about boundaries as one of these examples, the concept of boundaries. And of course, boundaries are very important things. We need to have our personal boundaries. However, in the capacity or in the context rather of mental health, people can also use boundaries to isolate themselves. Mm. The moment they get into a difficult relationship or a difficult, potentially confrontational situation or conversation, they can claim that this now infringes their boundaries. And they give themselves an excuse to check out and never learn how to deal with a difficult conversation or situation. So make sure the person who you're talking to, the people you're talking to, are holding up a good mirror, a real mirror, not just feeding your victimhood in any given moment.
So I'm going to conclude by sharing my thoughts and things on this as well, listening to our two experts here. I think parents, you need to be comfortable with your children not liking you at times. Teachers, you need to be comfortable with your students not liking you at times. And students, you need to recognize that when you don't like your parents at that particular time or your teacher, you need to question, are they really being mean and horrible, or are they actually doing their jobs properly? And recognize that, because one day when you're parents, hopefully you've learned that lesson. Then parents and teachers, this is a very important one. Kids do what you do. They don't do what you tell them to do. So if you do not have capacity, if you're not using the right skills to manage your life, you cannot expect your children to have the same thing. And kids, I'm not sharing this with you for you to weaponize it against the adults. This is guidance and mentoring for the parents and the adults in the room and the teachers in the room. Then for everybody, talking about what Jax was talking about now, about using vocabulary, the right psychological terms to describe things and not use it as an excuse. It's something that I feel quite strongly about. You build capacity by describing your reality realistically. If it's a scratch, it's a scratch. Rub some dirt on it and move on. If it's a little thorn that's in your side, it's not an injury. It is a thorn in your side. Describe it as it is, because if you hyperbolize it and catastrophize it, it feels a lot bigger than it really is. And I think you build capacity by realizing it's just a little drop in the ocean and not a tsunami that's hitting you every single time. I think what Jack said is very important too. It requires effort. It requires effort, a conscious effort, as with a relationship, as with anything meaningful in life, as with a job, as with stuff that you want to pursue. It requires effort to build capacity. And that effort means that you are sometimes going to put yourselves in positions that are uncomfortable, that you're scared. Be brave, because that's where the learning happens. Ask yourself, what is the worst thing that can happen realistically? And if the worst thing that can happen realistically is something you can deal with, then go ahead and do it. All right? And the last thing that I think is important for everybody adults, and children. Ask for help when you need it. Ask for counseling. When I say counseling, I don't necessarily mean professional counseling, but ask for counsel, for mentorship, when you need it. But asking for help is not asking to be rescued. When you ask for help understanding that you still have to do the work. The other person's not going to do the work for you, because that's not building capacity. Okay? And the last thing is that to become your best self is about your self journey, not someone else's journey. As you said, you have to carry the backpack. It requires effort. Does that make sense? Right. Do we have a mic? If there's one or two questions, we've got a couple of minutes that we can take. Just stand. And if anyone got questions that they would like to ask or any commentary they'd like to make.
Right. We must be very good.
So this is when I'm holding it. This says applause. Can you applaud? Thank you very much. Guys, I really hope that you found value in the conversation. And even if it's not direct value from what we're saying, but gives you an opportunity to go and reflect, to put some things in place for yourself, for your home, for your kids, for yourself, whatever, please go and do that. That's the purpose of this. It is thought leadership. It is sharing thought. We're not the experts. We are people on the same journey as you, maybe with a few more qualifications and experience than you, but all we're doing is sharing that with you with the hope that it builds you, help you build your own capacity. Okay. And gives you the vocabulary to do that, parents and students. Okay. Thank you very much for being here this evening. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.